You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. We head to the east coast of the United States on this episode, on the hunt for some of Virginia's most haunted inns and hotels. Our guide on our paranormal trip around the Old Dominion state is author Susan Schwartz, as we hear tales of all kinds of hauntings. We've a ghost that likes to dance, plenty of phantom cats galore, a deceased giant of the brewing industry, and we may even stumble across the ghost of the legendary Edgar Allan Poe. Thank you to Susan for being our delightful guide around one of the US's oldest states. But before all that, of course, don't forget you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up at patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. $4 a month gets you ad-free episodes, guaranteed early releases, bonus content, and more. You can also click the link in the show notes as always. Thank you to my latest patron, Dave, all the way from New Zealand. And thank you to each and every one of you that continues to support me and Mysteries and Monsters with your contributions. It is greatly appreciated. Mysteries and Monsters is across all social media platforms. Please subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube. We're almost at 3,000 subscribers, so help us over that line. Don't forget you can also visit mysteriesandmonsters.com for episodes, news and merchandise. Our intro and outro music are provided by the wonderful Weary Pines. Thank you to Dean Bestall as always for his marvellous artwork. The show is produced by Brendan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys, and Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange network. Rolling hills, majestic mountains, from the Shenandoah to the Atlantic, it seems that ghosts are everywhere in the state of Virginia. The Old Dominion State is our destination for this week's episode, as we visit one of the US's most historic states, with a history ingrained in the creation of the independent United States of America. It'll come as no surprise that ghosts and hauntings abound everywhere, it would seem. Joining me to guide us around Virginia's haunted hotspots is the author, Susan Schwartz. Susan, welcome to Mysteries and Monsters.
Ah, thank you for having me.
Thank you for bearing with us. We've had some ghosts in the machine, it would seem, before we've started this interview. So I'm very thankful for your kind patience as we got there in the end.
Oh, no worries. I was happy to do what I could. But yeah, it was definitely a ghost in our machine too, I think. Yeah, I agree with you on that.
So Susan, you're a woman who's had a career in the healthcare sector. You're an operation theatre nurse. You've clearly seen a lot of the traumas and the horrors of life. I'm intrigued as to how this has kind of led you into the world of the paranormal and your other work in horror fiction. Susan, were you a child that enjoyed reading scary stories late at night to yourself?
I was a big Stephen King fan, yes, but that didn't come along until I was about a teenager. My morbid background, I guess you'd call it, came about, you know, as a child, because when my family went to funerals, I mean, we'd stay the whole time. We'd wait for them to throw the last bit of dirt on the grave. We'd be taking pictures and everything else. So it was just a logical progression for me, because I just what I grew up with most of my life. So
when did you discover your passion for writing? Was it something that kind of came along, as you mentioned, because Stephen King, I think, is one of those authors that a lot of us, when we're in our teens, discover. And I think a lot of people, you can usually tell how much of a King fan or whatever with yes, with what book led them into it. I think the first one I read was Salem's Lot, which probably wasn't the smartest idea for a 13-year-old.
No.
It's one of three books I've had to put down for a bit and leave it for a week, Susan, and come back to it, along with It, strange enough, which I read about a year after Salem's Lot. So which one bit you first? Did you fall in love with Carrie, or was it, as many people say, it's Salem's Lot or It that kind of got them into it as well?
No, it was Carrie. I had just seen the movie and I was like, I'd like to read, because, you know, they always say his movies are worse than his books.
Mm.
So I said, well, let me read the book just to see. And sure enough, the book was way better. And I think after that one, I hit Pet Sematary and then just kind of branched out into short stories and other stuff he'd written. It was just fascinating world to me. I enjoyed it so much, which was kind of scary at the time because it was so gory, I guess you would say. But I really enjoyed his writing style. I enjoyed how he describe things and kind of made you feel like part of the scene. So very interesting writer, very prolific writer. So I have enjoyed things since, you know, Needful Things. I'm trying to think of all the books I've read by him. I've got 12 of them here on the shelf somewhere, but I really, really enjoy his writing. So I hope he keeps turning them out for us.
Well, that's the one thing I think he's one of those authors, Susan. I think if you're of a certain vintage like we are, King seems to have been with us all our lives, because obviously I started reading him in the mid-80s.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, it's probably nigh on 40 years since I've been started reading Stephen King. And obviously I had an older cousin who was obsessed with him. And so she would often pass down all the thumb-eared books that she'd read as well throughout that. Even well into the, sort of the 90s, she'd buy me the latest one as Christmas presents and things like Dolores Claiborne.
Aww.
And things like that.
Uh-huh.
So he's certainly, as tourist attractions go, he's probably the strangest reason that anybody would want to visit Maine, I think. Because when you read his books, it tends to tell you that there's a lot of terrible things hanging around and lurking in the shadows of Maine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I've heard many people have gone to visit his house, and I've heard he moved to Florida a little bit ago. So I don't know if he goes back or not, but it's like, I'd like to go see his house one day. So, you know, that's a bucket list thing, I guess. But yeah, Maine is Castle Rock. I think he based a lot of his stories up in Maine where he was. So,
yes. Well, he's probably earned a bit of sunshine. He's probably got sick of the winters in Maine as well.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah, it's just got to be bitter cold up there.
Yeah, I think he's all right. He's getting to a certain age that I think he could do with a bit more warmth all year round.
Mm-hmm.
I think, Susan.
Very
and he
much
cer-
so.
Certainly deserved it, I suspect.
Oh, yeah.
So was it King that kind of led you into keeping abreast with this? Because obviously, I think sometimes it's one thing to be a fan of paranormal fiction and horror stories before that kind of crosses over into the real stories and the collections of ghosts and hauntings that may be around you. I mean, obviously, growing up, were you aware of any of the local stories in Virginia as a child, or was that, once again, through Stephen King and other authors that you were reading as a young lady, did that kind of give you a sort of direction in regards to reading about real life hauntings?
I guess King gave me my first foray into it, yes, but I started reading this gentleman over here, you may have heard of him, L.B. Taylor. And he wrote a lot of books about Virginia, hauntings in Virginia, ghostly apparitions showing up here, there. I have most of his books myself. And once I started reading through them, I started going, hey, that place is right down the street. Or, hey, I could drive an hour to get here. And I started going to visit some of them. That was like in my 20s. I didn't actually start writing. My writing didn't pop up until I was in my 30s. And I started out with short stories, horror short stories. And then a friend of mine that was in a writer's club with me suggested I should try this because it was, you know, my love of travel, my love of the paranormal. And she says, this would be the perfect thing for you. So I started researching some places. The first book was Haunted Charlottesville, which is toward the middle of the Virginia state. And I started researching places and found, I don't know, 75, 80 that were actually quite good in the history and the ghostly happenings at the time. So I went around and, you know, I visited them. I took pictures. I took notes, did research once I got back home to make sure, you know, I had all the stories right and, you know, and had to contact them and make sure it was okay to include them in the book, of course. And did that one with the Haunted Charlottesville. With the Haunted Hotels, same kind of process. I just kind of started researching different places in Virginia that had some hauntings. And what I found, I went from one side of the state to the other, from Virginia Beach, which is over on the coast, to Bristol, Virginia, which is near the Tennessee border.
Mm.
And found a lot of different places along the 64 corridor, which is our main road over here for Virginia, to go from east to west. And just mainly a lot of research, a lot of travel, interviews and everything. And I actually enjoy doing that because I really enjoy learning new things. And I have found so many different places that I didn't even know existed that are historical in nature and need to be made aware of so people keep coming so that history can stay alive. And that's the most, you know, a rewarding thing for me, knowing that, you know, these places will carry on even though they may get old or decrepit or whatever, but they'll still be there because they're a historical building that needs to, you know, stay that way. So
was it, did you also, I mean, the one thing I love about hauntings and ghosts and things like this is that often, as you've just said there, Susan, it's taking you to places that you didn't know existed. You've discovered mm-hmm. historical sites and buildings that you probably would have never been aware of if it wasn't for paranormal interests. Would you say you had a love of history for the state prior to that? Or have you found that alongside your love of the paranormal, your love of an appreciation of history and historical sites has increased as you've done the books?
That's a very good question. I hated history when I was in school. I did not like it. I just, you know, and they say, you know, if you don't study it, you'll repeat it. But I didn't have a lot of history. My things were math and science, of course, and that kind of goes along with my career choice. But with these two books I've done covering most of Virginia, I think I have grown to love history a little bit more because I've learned so much about the Civil War. A lot of the places mentioned in both books cover a lot of the Civil War locations. I've learned a lot about Thomas Jefferson, who was our third president. I've learned so much about him because he had his finger in every pie in Virginia. Everywhere I researched, Thomas Jefferson owned this part of land, or Thomas Jefferson owned this building, or he helped put this together. So it was kind of a interconnectedness that really fascinated me about the whole process of writing this, because I was just fascinated with the history and how everybody was connected to everybody else. So it's actually kind of grown for me since I started writing, as opposed to before when I didn't really have any use for it, I guess you'd say.
Well, I think sometimes when you're a child or a student, Susan, it all depends on the type of history that you have to learn at school, I think, or at college, because in England and the rest of the UK, we spent far too long learning every king and queen that's ever ruled this country for the best part of 3 years. And so it essentially didn't seem to have any relevance until I got to about 14 or 15. And that was only when we got to the birth of the Industrial Revolution. So it's probably changed a lot since then, because why am I learning about all these kings when we're not even talking about Greece or the Greeks or the Romans or the Egyptians? Because we just focused on British history.
Right.
And obviously we didn't mention the War of Independence. Susan, we moved on from that period of our history. We let you go. That's what we learned. And long may that continue.
That's right.
But I think when you're a younger person, you can get really turned off by academic history because it tends to tell you about things you're not really interested in. And I would imagine that was probably the same for yourself.
I agree with that. Yes. I was more, like I said, more of a math science person. English I liked too, but history was just not, I just was not into it. So.
So, I mean, obviously, as you mentioned, you started writing fairly later in life after your career had begun to move on. Did you just take the plunge as a bit of a hobby, Susan, or was it something that, as many of us do at certain points in our life, when we're younger, especially in our teenage years, we have dreams about what we can and can't do, and then reality kicks in and we have to put sometimes our dreams on the back burner for quite a while. Was it something you'd always wanted to do, or did you just come to a point in your life where you thought, I might give this a go, as you were saying about your friend introducing you to a writer and a book club, that you just thought, yeah, I think I'll give this a go. What's the worst that could happen?
Well, that was my thought too. What's the worst that could happen? But no, this started for me back in probably 2003-ish, somewhere in there. I was diagnosed with fibromyalgia, and which is can be painful, can be, you know, very depressing.
Yes.
And I started writing like in a journal to get some of those feelings and thoughts out. I called it poison, and to write it, you know, put it on paper, kind of got the poison out, so to speak. And I did that for a while, and I had joined a writer's club in 2006 and started learning how to write, you know, properly, punctuation, tense of word. And what happened was I played around for a couple of years there just to see how it was and such. I had written, like, I guess over here we call it fan fiction. And what that is like you'd watch a TV show and say you didn't like the ending of it, so you kind of rewrote it to your liking.
Yes.
That's kind of what I had been doing. And I had this love affair with medical thrillers at the time. Michael Palmer was one of my favorite writers. And I was like, I could try that because I got a lot of stories I could tell, you know, being a nurse and all that. And so I started writing. I guess I'd written like maybe three chapters of the book. And the guy that was running the writer's club said, well, bring it over to me. Let's see how we do it. He said, bring four or five copies so everybody can have a look. And I'm going, no. So I took the five copies and I handed them out. And I said, please be gentle. I said, this is my first time. And, you know, most people were very nice and, you know, pointed out mistakes. And then there was this one man that just, he had a red pen and he was just all over. He bled all over that paper. And I didn't even bother to look at it, to be honest with you, because I was just so appalled. I was like, how dare you? And so I threw it to the side for a while, and I went back the next month, and he says, did you like my suggestions? And I said, I haven't looked at them yet. And he said, why? And I said, well, I just was so appalled at all that red ink. And he said, take a look and let me know. And he said, if I was too rough with you, we'll talk about it. And I said, that's fair. So I came home, and I looked, and I picked it up, and I looked at it, and you know, and I hate to admit this, but the man was right. Yeah, these men sometimes get it right. But he had so many good suggestions, so many good ways to say something. And I was very, very new. My paragraphs would say, this was, she was, it was, blah, blah. And he took that and rewrote the paragraph to show me how it should have, you know, with clauses and, you know, putting sentences together and, you know, mixing it up a little bit more than I had. And I was like, oh, my God, I can do that. And I kind of got excited about it, started writing over here, working on that novel. And that same friend that helped me, talk me into writing the haunted books, told me about this trilogy, this horror trilogy that was coming out. And she goes, you should write something for that. She says, you have lots of good stories. And so I looked at it, and I said, okay, I'll try one just to see. And so I did one. It was based in the OR course because you write what you know. And they loved it. So they got in touch with me for the next 2 years when they did the trilogies, 1, 2, and 3. And they said, you want to contribute? So I'm like, sure. It was a bunch of us, like 8 to 10 authors, I think. And all the proceeds would go to St. Jude's Hospital here in the U.S. And I figured it was a good cause. So I went ahead and did it. And that's kind of how I got into writing. It was just, I think, by accident because of the health issues, but I kept on as a hobby because I like it. It's the most, I guess, frustrating thing I've ever done, but it's also has its rewards once you get to see your name, you know, in print. So that's kind of how that happened.
I suppose, like you say then, as you were referring to getting the poison out, it would have been very therapeutic because I've got a couple of my mm-hmm. friends that I've got to know over the years, Susan, who both suffer from fibromyalgia. So it's something that whilst I don't have first-hand experience of it, thankfully, I'm aware of it. So for some of them, mm-hmm. they have days where they just feel like they can't do anything. It's like their entire body's screaming at them.
Mm-hmm.
And so I suppose it gave you a way of fighting back a little bit and finding a bit of comfort in being able to actually sit down and do something without sort of feeling sorry for yourself and how dilapidating the pain must be.
I think that was probably that's a good way to explain that, yes.
So obviously you've got bitten by the bug. So did you plan to sort of branch out into investigating your local paranormal history? Was it a personal experience or were you one of those people that you'd always been interested in the paranormal, Susan? But I think to go from writing short stories to then do your first book, which is obviously based on around Charlottesville and everywhere like that, or Sealand, as the locals call it, I believe. When you go from that kind of jump from writing short stories to the first book that you did, I mean, that's quite an undertaking, because whilst you're talking about specific things, the Haunted Charlottesville book has a fair number. I mean, you're talking dozens of reports. It's not just, you know, one or two here and there. I mean, there's mm-hmm. probably near enough 50 alleged hauntings in that particular volume, isn't there?
Haunted Charlottesville, I think, has 65, if I'm not mistaken. Mm. 65 to 70. So, yes.
So when you were drafting that, did you start in, as the chapters are basically headed in certain towns and cities in the state, did you start at one end and move across? I know obviously you've done that in the Virginia book, where you've kind of branched out and covered a specific genre of hauntings, whereas in the Charlottesville one, did you start in one particular location and work your way around? Because obviously, as we said, you're based in Goochland. So did you do that chapter first, or did you just start somewhere else and just think, oh, well, I'm going to go wherever I can?
Well, the thing is, with this one, the first place I went to in this book was Tuckahoe Plantation. And that's where Thomas Jefferson grew up when he was a small child, went to school there and everything. We went to Tuckahoe, but the book is 13 counties from a county that's above Charlottesville all the way to Goochland, which is where I live.
Mm.
And I kind of went wherever I had to go on certain days. Some days I'd be over, there's a place in here called Culpeper. Some days I'd be over there. Some days I'd be in Brandy Station. Sometimes I'd be in Charlottesville. Sometimes I'd be in Goochland. So it was a case of not really planning. It was a case of, when can I schedule these interviews and when can I... My brother took my pictures, and it was also a case of when we could schedule being together so we could both research, interview, and everything while he took pictures on the outside or the inside if we had a tour or something. But no, I didn't follow any kind of plan, because with this, you really can't, because some days you're here, some days you're there, some days you're home writing. So it's like, you just kind of do where it takes you and, you know, go from there. It's kind of haphazard, but I guess it took me about 2 years to get all the information and everything together for the Haunted Charlottesville book. So it wasn't a fast process at all, but it was an enjoyable one, I will say that.
Well, that's one of the great points about the books as well, is that you've taken the time. You've not used stock photos. As you were saying, your brother's done a lot of some fabulous... He's a very talented photographer, I have to say. There's some rather lovely pictures in there. I think this is one of those things that we forget sometimes about certain states in the US, that Virginia's got a very distinct architectural style. There's a lot of sort of old colonial buildings, which I find quite beautiful, really, in regards to everything else. But there also seems to be one of those periods where people were just building all kinds of crazy looking and yet beautiful mm-hmm. buildings as well. So I suppose it gives you, as we were saying earlier, it gives you a real appreciation of the state's beauty in its buildings, because often mm-hmm. you can kind of miss that, I think, sometimes, Susan.
Well, you get caught up in the details and you forget to look at the whole picture. So, you know, some of these we went to, and I remember thinking to myself, okay, I got to go in here, get this interview, talk to this person. But then I have to remind myself, go outside and walk around and see what the building's like, because I really like to include descriptions and other things, you know, in the book when I'm writing them. And I always have to remind myself, go outside and look at the whole building, so we don't, you know, forget to do that. So, yeah, I totally agree with that. It's you can quite honestly forget about the beauty of what you're looking at because you're so focused on something else.
And I think it's one of those places as well where sometimes it's history and its relevance in literary history can often be overlooked, because obviously Edgar Allan Poe visited the Virginia University. So mm-hmm. this is a place where it has clearly been a focal point for a lot of visitors from all around the world, especially the university. Even our old queen came to visit and spent some time there. And presidents have often come around. I think, is it Roosevelt's son graduated from the university as well? So it's not just its historic history. It's continued to see visitors that we know as famous people these days all throughout mm-hmm. its life. It's not just something that happened at the birth of the nation or during the war for independence.
Oh, yes. Yeah, very true. And Also, you were talking about UVA. There's another, it's Woodrow Wilson. Woodrow Wilson was a president. I don't remember what number, I apologize. But he was a president for the U.S., and he also has a room over there. It's somewhere near Pose. It's like number 13 or 14 down there, but his has got a little sign over top of it that says, you know, Woodrow Wilson stayed here when he was a student. And then Poe, of course, has his own room that's kind of glassed off there at UVA. And they have a neat little story. You go up and you push a little button at the door. You can look inside and see what the room looked like when he was there in the 1800s. And you can push a little button and it'll tell you some history about Poe and the college itself. That's a real fascinating place to just spend the day, because there's just so much to see up there.
I suppose as well, one of the other aspects of going on a haunted road trip is visiting some of these cemeteries as well, because often this is one of those things that gets overlooked as well, because as we've said, it's not afraid of looking back to its past, because there's been some major battles that have gone on in this particular state over the years, outside of the War of Independence. And obviously there were some issues during the Civil War as well, Susan. It's a place, like we say, because I think it was, you know, we're talking very early 17th century when the English mm-hmm. turned up there, that people have lived and commuted in that area for over 400 years now. So it's got history wherever you look. But as you say, sometimes I think people seem to stay within the major places these days, and they forget about all these towns and their histories and the places that people have gone through over those years. And cemeteries are one of those aspects that can sometimes get overlooked in the modern era, whereas 100, 150 years ago, these were key sites for people for remembrance, and also for family gatherings and the like.
Well, we have one down here in Richmond. I don't know if you guys have ever heard of it. It's called Hollywood Cemetery, and it has, I think it has two or three presidents buried there. It has a lot of Civil War soldiers buried there. And I've talked to people that live down in that area. We call it downtown Richmond. And I've talked to people that live downtown and say, you know, have you ever been over there? There's this neat site here or there. No, we've never been there. And I say, how long have you lived in Richmond? And, you know, it's like 15, 20 years. So you bring up a good point in that I think people miss things that are right in their backyard because they want to go see this, you know, like thousands of miles away. So again, you know, going back to what we said before, you tied up in the details, but you miss the big picture. So I totally agree with that statement, as you said it. So.
Yeah, I mean, you've got, I think the other one that I'm aware of is it Maplewood, which was the first public cemetery in Virginia, which is one of those things. I think sometimes we think back and think, what do you mean a public cemetery? But then again, this is another one where you've also got all these beautiful stones and some fabulous statues and gravestones and things like that. But you've also got these mysterious aspects to that particular location where you've got a lot of unmarked graves as well, which I think some people might be a bit confused by.
They did that a lot back then. I think just stuff that I've seen, sometimes families with slaves would bury the, you know, the slaves within their family plot, but they wouldn't be they would not be marked. I've seen it with something from the Charlottesville book was Samuel McHugh, who was accused of killing his wife, Fanny. And I believe it was back in 1906, if I'm not mistaken, but he was accused of killing her. And so they put him in jail and they wound up hanging him. And what happened was he was buried somewhere in Virginia for a while until Fanny passed, or Fanny, the gravesite needed to be dug up beside her. And so what they wound up doing was they went and got him from, I think it was somewhere up north. They brought him here and they buried him beside her in the graveyard, but they never marked his stone either. He's just kind of, they just know he's there. There's no stone. There's no clarification that he's even there, but people have, I guess, x-rayed or something to make sure it's the body's down there or whatever. But so I think there's a lot of that going on throughout Virginia because of slavery and some other things. But I saw, what was that place? Gray Haven Winery in Louisa. They have a huge, huge vineyard, and they have some woods that run on the sides of it. And she took us, I think it's in the book, in fact, the lady Max that owns it with her husband, she took us on a tour around the woods and was showing us this graveyard that had a lot of hills in it and a lot of trenches, like they look like trenches. And She said that it was about 18 to 19 slaves buried there, but there were no headstones whatsoever. They just happened to, I think they were cleaning or something, she told me, and they found some bones and such. But I think that was how they did it back then. And I think today, at least I hope with today's, the way people are in today's world, that, you know, people get a headstone because you need to know who that person is. You need to know, you know, what years they were here. I mean, to me, that's just fascinating to just stand there and go, well, I wonder what he did back in the 1800s, you know.
Yes.
It's something that that history fascinates me as it pertains to people. And I really like seeing that. It just breaks my heart sometimes. I go in a cemetery and, you know, the gravestone's broken. You can't read their name or anything because the stone is like from the 1600s and you just can't read it anymore. And it's, that just breaks my heart because now we don't know who this person was. And if it was that long ago, they probably don't have the records either. So it's one of those things. I understand why it was done, but like I said, in today's world, I hope it's a lot better for people, because I don't think anybody should have to be nameless in a grave. So
I mean, it is one of those questions that I can ponder here, because I'm very interested as to why. Because you can wander around many a cemetery, especially where I live here in Sheffield. We've got two or three fairly large ones, even for a city the size of Sheffield, Susan. And you can see up to a certain point, sort of like the mid-19th century, that when somebody passed away, it would put their profession on here. And so it would say that they were a tailor or a miner, or that they worked in banking or something like that. It would tell you what they did.
Oh, nice.
Which is quite interesting. And it makes you wonder why did people stop doing that? Because it's one of those things, because I'm one of those people, whenever I visit somewhere I've never been before, I do like a nice wander around a graveyard, precisely like you've said, because I think you can learn a lot about the place and the people and the history by just having a wander. And you have little quirks, like you'll see any names of people you know, or for me, because my surname's quite unique where I live, Bestall, often if I see anybody with a name quite similar to mine, I'll be quite surprised, because it's not that common a name depending where you go. Or you'll see a variation of it, like Restall or Destall, but I've okay. Outside of my family, I've yet to see a grave with that my surname on it wherever I've been, in the United Kingdom and abroad especially. But I suppose it does give you a real sort of sense of time and place, because often when you're going in these places, like you say, Susan, you're looking at graves from 200 years ago, and you do think to yourself, what was that person doing? How did they get there?
Yeah, I've done a lot of traveling, and, you know, one of the places we've been is Pompeii. And just looking, I don't know if you've ever been there, but we just went, the last trip we took was like in 2019, and we were there like 20 years before that. But what fascinated me the most was the difference in the trips, in that they've, you know, dug out some more homes, and some of them have some artwork or some mosaics, whatever, you know, on the floor and the ceiling, wherever they put them. But for me, it was just walking in there going, now I wonder what they did here, you know. And that's, I mean, we're talking back when Vesuvius erupted. So that's been a long, long time ago. And the fascinating thing about that place was I found the cemetery in Pompeii, believe it or not. And they were very ornate graves, very big, very ornate, just fascinated with that. Because, I mean, it was so long ago, but there were no names or anything on them, or years or that I could see. They probably had been, I guess, at one time. But that kind of, like I said before, that kind of history really fascinates me, because it brings to life, you know, these people that lived back in this time, and this is how they lived, and this is what they did. And it's, I really like that human factor in there when we do that. So
I suppose it's one of those strange things when we think about history, and especially like you say, I think Vesuvius erupted in 79 AD, so it's nearly 2,000 years ago. Susan, you know, it's two millennia. it's one of those things that, when you go, it's amazing when you go to places like that and you just look at how well preserved, despite the fact that it was covered in ash for the best part of 2,000 years, that how much has been preserved, probably because of the ash, that it saved so much of it.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, like you say, I think we sometimes seem a bit surprised when we stumble across graveyards from that era, because I think sometimes we don't think that these people were sophisticated enough to treat people respectfully when they passed. I'm not sure where that kind of comes from, but you can see it all over the world with cultures all over. People passing it seems to have been the one thing that all kind of cultures had a very respectful process for. However they did it, they all did it in a way that they weren't discarded. And I think sometimes we look back at the past and we think that these people lacked intelligence or sophistication. And yet when it came to respecting their dead, they were clearly people who had a lot of time and processes and respect for their loved ones, even in those days.
Oh, I totally agree. And I mean, I still do it to this day. I guess I was taught when I was little not to do it, but I will not step on anybody's grave. I will walk down the side of it. And if I do step on them, I will say, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. It's just the way I am. But people will look at me going through the grave and go, sorry, sorry, sorry. But, you know, I don't think it's right to step on them. I think you still need to respect that person that's down there in their grave. So, and I think that's just part and parcel of how I grew up. But, you know, I know some people go right across there and I was like, it just makes me cringe inside. It's like, oh, don't do that. But the respect needs to be there because, I mean, they were people once too. So, you know, I think it's just carrying it on from generation to generation to make sure it stays.
Mm. I think one of the most striking places that you cover in the Charlottesville book is Castalia Manor. What a beautiful place. It's, as I was saying about some of these strange locations and the architecture that they're there, it seems like some kind of Spanish garrison that's been transplanted into the heart of America, really. It's a beautiful place, and it's one of those where it seems to be chock full of ghosts as well as visitors.
That one is just the front gate. We could not get in to take a picture of the house, which I wish we could have because I've seen pictures of it. It's very pretty. But it's a three-story house, and it's down there in the mountains of Charlottesville, so it's got very pretty backgrounds and everything. And, yeah, they've got a lot of stuff going on. I know people had gotten up, like, to get a drink or something, and they switched on the light and clothes are over a chair that should have been somewhere else. Or I think one of the girls' dogs went barking, and the family came down to see what was going on with him, and he kept on pointing toward the stairs, but he wouldn't go up them. And they've had a lot of different things happen there. I see what you're saying about the Spanish thing. Very beautiful grounds there, like I said, back in the mountains. And this was our mountain day, I think. We had a couple of places we went back in there, but a lot of different things. What fascinated me about this place was Hans Holzer came to investigate it. And I love anything he's written, so I've got most of his books as well. But he did an investigation. That's what I'm trying to say. He did an investigation there. I think he brought a psychic with him, if I'm not mistaken. And it was a older woman that had passed, and they had lights coming on and some other stuff. So I think that these nice people can still hang out even after they're gone. So you have to be careful.
Yes, very much so. I was quite struck that there seems to be something there that likes making a mess as well, because people are always saying about clothes being thrown about.
Well, I tell you, we had, if I'm not mistaken, they had thrown the clothes over a chair one night in their bedroom, and they were gone the next morning, and I think they showed up somewhere else. And so they discovered the clothes they had hung over a chair were now thrown on the floor. Yeah. And an open book sitting there that wasn't on the bed before. So yeah, it must be a messy ghost, because I tell you, we went to a place, I think it was in another state somewhere, but we'd gone on this haunted tour, and they had a lady ghost. She would wash the dishes and make the beds, and I was like, can she come home with me? So, you know, it's nice to see that, you know, people, they still do what they used to do, and they think that the lady ghost was, she was either a past maid at this particular location, or she was like a owner slave or something. And but she said they do find the dishes done the next morning, or sometimes the clothes have been folded, and or the beds were made or something. I was like, oh, I need her with me. She needs to come home with me.
Yeah, I mean, usually tidy ghosts are a rare occurrence, Susan.
That's right.
It's usually the exact opposite. I mean, I suppose, obviously, did that give you then a thirst for moving on to your most recent book, which is obviously you've decided to try and visit and locate as many of the haunted inns and hotels that Virginia has. Was that something that you kind of built off the back of the first book, or was that something that you'd planned to do? Because obviously that's your most recent book that came out about towards the end of the summer last year.
Mm-hmm.
So was that something you'd always had an interest in? Because obviously it's the same here in the UK. Sometimes certain places you can't move for haunted pubs and hotels.
No, I had something else entirely different on my mind from my second book, but this one kind of fell in my lap. A gentleman had asked me if I was interested, and I was like, yeah, because, I mean, I've stayed in a couple of, two or three of these hotels that are listed in here, in fact, and, saw some weird stuff, but never really paid attention because I didn't know they were haunted. So when he asked me about it, I was like, sure, I'll do that. So I took another 2 years, year and a half years to do this one, and I used a lot of places, a couple of places I had been, and then also did the research. And like I said, it kind of follows the Civil War across Virginia from Virginia Beach to Bristol. And I found a lot of places in here that I probably would have never even looked twice at. But the stories were so fascinating in some of them that I want to go by and just see what the place looked like. And I went one Saturday. In fact, I hadn't even called anybody. I just said, let's stop at a few on the way where we're going and just see if I can talk to somebody. And it was Richard Johnston Inn and the Black Horse Inn. They said, come on in, let's talk. The owner was there, and he sat me down, and we talked a little bit about each of the different occurrences and the different hauntings. One place had like four, I think, and the Richard Johnston Inn, I had 1, 2, 3. I remember 4 right now. It probably was more, but it was just a logical progression. After the guy asked me, he says, you want to do it? I'm like, sure, I'll do it, because, I like to travel. So I did that, and then the one I wanted to do for my second book I'm working on now. So I got back to my roots.
I suppose the benefit of doing a book about haunted inns and hotels as well, Susan, is that, as you say, you can just turn up and hope that somebody's there that's willing to talk to you. But you can also just not tell them what you're doing and book a room and stay there without, and sort of do it on the undercover, as it were.
I did that in several of the places I had stayed at before. One place was, what's it called? The Alexandrian, or Hotel Monaco. And I had stayed there many, many times in the past. So we were going up to Alexandria at the time. And so we were looking for a hotel. And I told my husband, I said, well, let's stay there because I need to get some pictures and such for my book. So we went and stayed. I think we stayed like 2 or 3 nights. And I got some pictures of the stairwells and some places that were supposedly haunted and some other things. So, and I think that one also had a place down the street, Carlisle House, I believe, used to be a hospital. And apparently when you walk on the ground, some people can hear this big thud, thud, thud. And apparently there was, if I'm not mistaken, a fire or something happened at the hospital, and it caused the patients to jump out the windows, which is the thud you hear landing on the ground. But the day I went, and I had a recorder with me, and I heard several thuds, and I was by myself. My husband was in the car waiting for me, so I was there on the grounds by myself. And it was just fascinating to hear, going, oh my gosh. So those are still going on.
I'm often surprised as well with some locations. Some of them don't really like to talk about the ghosts. It's as though it's an open secret, but the staff don't or aren't allowed to talk about it. Did you come across that more often than not? Or do you think in the modern era where paranormal tourism is really taking off for a lot of places, Susan, some of them have been a bit more receptive to people like yourself and other sort of paranormal investigators that are interested in a location's haunted history rather than just what kind of food and drink they can get there?
For the most part, people were interested in sharing the information. I had several places that I had written up and I had found out they didn't want to be included. It was a case of, we don't want those people to come here and start investigating and looking for stuff because that might scare other customers from staying in the rooms. And, and that's okay. I understand that. A lot of places didn't want any publicity, I guess is a good word, about this other part of their hotel. So I had to take about 5 hotels I had in here out because they did not want to be part of it. And that's perfectly fine. I respected that. But for the most part, I mean, most of them were welcoming. And then, I tell them, hey, I'm writing this book. And they go, oh, well, let me tell you about this. And let me tell you about this. And There was one, I think it was a Natural Bridge Hotel. I met this little guy named Josh, and he was telling me some stories about Natural Bridge. And then he goes, have you checked out Roanoke, Hotel Roanoke? And I said, it's on my list. I haven't gotten there yet. And he says, well, let me tell you some stuff about that, because apparently he used to work there or something. But so it was a case of, you know, hey, you know, come on in. We'll talk to you, let you know what's going on. You know, if there's nobody in the room, maybe, you know, you could go up there and look. I didn't get to do that a whole lot because there were guests staying in a room. And, you know, as I put a big caveat in the book, do not bother guests that are in specific rooms.
Yes.
Because, I mean, you know, they may be in there just totally unaware. And then you say, hey, anything weird happening in there? Why?
Yeah, do you have a good night's sleep?
You have to be careful. Yeah, really. You have to be careful. And so, but I talked to mostly, you know, the owner or the manager or somebody working the front desk that would know what was going on most of the time. And, I mean, it just, I think it's, I think myself, for myself, it would attract me to go there even more because of what could be happening and can I stay in this room and, you know, that and the other. But I think a lot of the hotels and looking at it going, you know, well, this is going to scare some of our customers, so we don't want to do this. And, you know, like I said, that's okay too. I mean, you have to respect what each business wants to do. So I try to do that. And for the most part, all these in here now said yes, so they didn't have a problem with it. But I certainly understand why some hotels would.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, one of the ones that we've got to talk about, really, because I'd even heard of this place before I'd read your book, Susan, is the Cavalier Hotel. Primarily, mm-hmm. As I was saying before we started the conversation properly, I stumbled across the haunted history of the Cavalier Hotel when I was watching something about the Lemp family, who were a brewery family from the late 19th century, early 20th century, who apparently were cursed.
Uh-huh.
And lots of members of their family died in tragic circumstances, and they made terrible decisions, and people were convinced that the whole family was cursed, and their estate was a deeply unhappy place. And as part of that, it mentioned the Guinness family, because there's an alleged curse with the Guinness family as well. And obviously, the Cavalier Hotel is probably most famous for the strange death of Adolf Coors, who is obviously famous for the Coors Brewery. But also, that family has a very checkered and tragic history in a variety of ways. But Coors is a very strange man, because obviously he was German and stowed away on a boat and turned up in America. And he seemed very quickly to come from rags to riches. He's a very interesting character, because I think he was in the US about 8 years, and by that point he'd got his own brewery, which is remarkable, really.
Yeah.
So when the stories of Adolf Coors have come, I mean, this is obviously the scene of his tragic passing, which some people have said that he fell out the window, he had an accident, he tripped up. Some people have said that he sadly took his own life. Other people have claimed he was pushed. Even the story that isn't paranormal seems to have its own sort of special history.
Well, I mean, he was 80-ish, yes. I believe. And I remember that too. Some people said he was pushed. Sometimes he jumped. I don't know. When I researched it, I couldn't find anything else except for what I had in the book. So I think that's something that's going to go down in history, is we don't know what happened. But I do know that the neat thing about him was there were some guests staying at the hotel, I believe it was, used to say when they stood in the exact spot that he fell, they'd hear a big thud sometimes. So I guess he's still jumping out that window. But I know a paranormal tour guy down there, Al Tuning, he used to have a picture he would show at group tours, and they never knew. It was a wedding back in the 70s, and there was an older gentleman in the picture, and they never could figure out who he was. And one day when Tuning held up the picture of Coors during a tour, a woman screamed. She attended the same wedding where the picture had been taken years before, and the man in the picture looked just like the unidentified gentleman who was Adolf Coors. So he apparently was at the wedding as well as messing around the hotel too. So, but he did have a kind of a checkered past. So I hope that he is at peace now, though.
Yeah, I must admit, when I saw him pop up in your book, I thought, I'll just have a read about this character. There's not a lot of people don't have a lot of nice things to say about him. That's the politest. I saw several descriptions of the type of person he was, Susan, and I'm not going to use them in your company. But not a lot of people had a lot of kind words for him. And they're a very strange family because I think his one of his Adolf Kors the Third was kidnapped and murdered by somebody in the 60s. I think his sister committed suicide. There's a lot of tragedy in that particular family. Mm-hmm. And I was perplexed by this story about him turning up in a wedding photo because everything I'd read about him, he seemed to be the kind of person who would have avoid happiness and frivolity as much as he possibly could by going on what people said about him.
Yeah, you would think so. He just stayed in his room and not even come out, but apparently he made the appearance for that one. So,
yeah.
Oh, he decided to make, they said he decided, oh, that's me. That's me being funny. He decided to make sure his beverages were used at the wedding. But that's just me being funny. But yeah, he did have a sad life, but like I said, I hope he's at peace with himself now. So
it's got some strange ghosts as well. It's not often you come across a ghost with two types of animal ghosts, because I know there are people that they're supposed to be a lady with a dog, and then there's this story about the girl and her pet cat.
Oh, the cat. Yeah, the little girl got lost, the cat got lost, and she went to look for it, and I think it wound up in the hotel pool. And she wound up drowning, trying to save it, as well as the animal drowned. And I think somebody had said that they could hear cats meowing outside their doors, or they'd hear small children, what sounded like a small child or children running up and down the hallway. So it was really fascinating to hear some of the stories. The author mentioned in here, Pamela Kinney, is the one that was telling me about it. At the time I went to see it here, it was at Christmas time, and it wasn't anybody I could speak with at the time, so I never did get a chance to go back. This is actually her story that I'm sharing here.
Mm-hmm.
And she was telling me about that little girl, and she said she was kind of fascinated with her, with some of the meows and stuff that people were hearing. And I think somebody had said they had laid down in one room and near where the pool was, and they felt this something jump up on the bed, you know, with them, like a cat would do, and they turned the light on, and there was nothing there. So I think they're making their rounds.
You know, Pamela's been on this show as well, and she never told me she'd done some ghost hunting, so I'll have to pick her up next time I speak to her about that. That's very interesting. Yeah, it's got all sorts. I mean, I know that the hotel was shut for renovations for a few years as well, and I've seen stories that the elevators carried on working even though nobody was using them.
I did not come across that in my research. I did not know that. Interesting.
Yeah.
But I've heard of that at several different other hotels. A couple in Washington, in fact, had some stories, not in this book, of course, but there's some stories about the May Adams, I believe it is, that the hotel, the elevator will just go up and down by itself and nobody's on it. They're just kind of, and it goes, I think it's a particular time, like 8 o'clock at night. It always comes to one different floor because there was a president, and I don't remember who, I'm sorry, but there was a president that used to come down every night about that time to have dinner or something, and that elevator would always be there at that exact time. So I thought it was kind of neat too.
I'm surprised as well. There seems to be a few locations where, as we mentioned him earlier, Edgar Allan Poe seems quite a frequent visitor to some of these places. Do you find that surprising, or do you think, similarly to here in the UK and other places, Susan, that certain locations are more known for their celebrity ghost or their alleged celebrity ghosts than the actual hauntings that may be going on?
Yeah, I would say so in some places. I think Poe was, he was either stationed at, the one I'm thinking about is Fort Monroe.
Mm-hmm.
And you talk about Poe being there. I think he was stationed there, or he was there for some reason. I don't remember the exact thing, but I know he's seen usually, I think it's in the number five barracks building, and where he lived while he was on base. Oh, so he was there. I just found the thing. And he also returned to present some poetry about a month before he died in Baltimore. So I think he probably had some ties to this place because he was there living on base for a while, and then he also came back and did some readings, you know, real close to when he died. So, I mean, not very good ties, so to speak, but he had some ties with the place, kind of like, you know, UVA, the West Range over there where his room is. He got some ties there, so, you know, it's feasible he may show up there. There's the old stone house in Richmond which is about, you know, an hour from me, they have a lot of Poe memorabilia. They have, in fact, they have the staircase from his old house they put there. So it's a Poe shrine is what it is. And it's just really neat to go there and see, you know, things back from his life, you know, a lock of hair, his wedding ring, pictures of when he got married to Elmira Royster. So I think he's got like Jefferson. He had his finger in a few pies in Virginia. And they also have down the street, they also have a place called Poe's Pub where they'll celebrate on certain evenings. They celebrate the unhappy hour. So, yeah. So it's a case. He's got a lot of Virginia ties. And I think, you know, this is not surprising to see him, you know, in places where he visited in life as well.
I was quite surprised. I didn't know there was such a connection with him, because, like I say, a lot of people would be surprised, even though he was stationed there. It seems that Virginians have certainly taken Poe to their heart.
Oh, I'm a big fan of Poe. I love Poe. So, you know, he's got that shrine downtown. And I mean, it must have 600-700 members or more, because it's just people are just so intrigued with him and his writing. And the sad part is he didn't make anything off his writing until after he died, kind of like Emily Dickinson. They both got rich after they died. And I mean, he was just a brilliant, brilliant writer. I mean, I love like The Telltale Heart,
yeah,
The Raven. I mean, who could come up with stuff like that? And this, the one word he invented that I always loved was tintinnabulation of the bells. You know, the bells, bells, bells. And I've gone to the Richmond cemeteries and seen all those graves. I've been to Baltimore and seen his grave. So I think he's just an intriguing figure in history, writing history anyway. And he's just, you know, he's a fascinating man. And I think, you know, to learn more about him and his life could lead us to why he wrote some of the stuff that he did. So, you know, it's just a research forward and see what we find. But I think Virginia is a Poe state because, you know, he grew up here, he went to school here, and it's kind of like one of our own, I guess.
Yeah, but it shows the power, though. I think, you know, here we are, what, 175 years after he passed away, Susan, and people still read his books, people still adapt. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously, we've had the recent success of Netflix with the House of Usher. Which is my personal favorite, Poe, along with the Murders of the Rue Morgue, because that's just a crazy story.
Very much so. And
it shows you that when you look back and you're looking at some of the themes that he was covering and the work he was doing and the way he was writing, it is quite surprising that he wasn't more famous in his era. And it just shows you sometimes that people are not appreciated in their particular time period, and it's testament to the quality of his work and the depth of his despair that he shared with us, I suspect, that here we are, we can still talk about this and people still adore him to this day. It's incredible, really, that he didn't achieve more success in his lifetime before his very that's the other aspect of all this, is that obviously, regardless of his body of work and his mysterious life, you've also got his very strange death as well, which I think has simply magnified his legacy, really.
Oh, there were so many things they said. It was, you know, he was drunk, he was alcoholic, he was beat up and put there in the ditch in Baltimore. He was used for fake voting for some kind of a thing. I don't remember exactly what it's called, but they used to pull people off the street and just make them go vote and then, you know, throw them in the ditch. So, and then somebody said he had pneumonia or something else. And it's like, you know, I mean, it seemed, but you know, back then they didn't have the medical background that we do today. So, you know, I can kind of forgive him for that. But I mean, I'd love to know what happened to that poor man. But I guess that's another mystery that'll go down in history as well.
Yeah, that's something else to add to the time machine list if we ever get one invented, I think, Susan.
There you go. There you go.
Just be hanging around that street in Baltimore and just see what happens. So, I mean, one of the stories that made me chuckle, and it's not much more than a couple of lines, is the Black Horse Inn that has a dancing ghost. What's all this about, Susan?
The Black Horse Inn, that was the one I was talking about before, that I think it has four ghosts in it. And the dancing ghost was famous for tap dancing up the stairs. Well, see, what happens is when you go in the front door, there are bilateral stairs, one on each side. And this ghost would get up, you know, when most people were sleeping, so, you know, probably in the middle of the night, he'd get up there and start tap dancing on the stairs. And I know one of the owners had come out and said, well, you know, of course we go up there and tell him to be quiet, but he never is. So they put up with him, you know, because what are they going to do? Tell him he can't stay there? I mean, but yeah, that I know they said the dancing ghost was that one. And there was a giggling nurse. She was a Civil War nurse. And she was same problem. They could hear her giggle. She'd just laugh and laugh and laugh. And they think it was trying to keep the patients there happy, because the front rooms of this particular inn were hospital type rooms during the Civil War, kind of like a makeshift hospital. And they'd come in and the lady would try to keep her patients happy and laughing and all. And that's what the laughing ghost is. But the dancing one, yeah, he gets up on top of the stairs and just, they said he makes a racket. Oh my goodness. So I thought that was kind of neat. And then I think the other one I was trying to remember to tell you about was named Stooge. And he would go through the inn and knock down all the Christmas trees. He did not like Christmas trees at all. And she finally had to put them up on hooks with twine so he couldn't knock them over.
How strange. I mean, it's a very... Because often you'll hear about certain places having more than one particular ghost, Susan. But the Black Horse Inn, they seem to have real characters there, which is not often, you know, people say sometimes they'll see the form of a lady, or there'll be a man running about, whereas this one, they seem to be so well established that they've got their own characters, and for one of them not to like Christmas is a very strange thing.
Oh, I thought so too, but after she told me about the stories of him knocking over the trees, I said, you know, the name kind of fits.
I mean, did you come across any other kind of locations in your journey where you got such defined ghosts that the owners and the staff had got names for? Because that's a really great collection of varied spirits. I mean, two of them seem quite happy and one of them seems very grumpy, which is another contrast as well, because you don't usually have a dancing ghost at them anywhere.
Oh, no, you don't get to see that too often. To answer your question, I have two actual places in mind that I can speak of about ghosts that have names and such that they've named. Bell Grove Plantation, which is in up near Fredericksburg. And then there's another one, Dunlore Inn, over here in Mineral. And they have a number of entities in both places. And I was fascinated. I did not get to go to Bell Grove Plantation because COVID had just began at the time. And I could not get a scheduled interview with her to speak with her. But she did talk to me over the phone and tell me some things that had been going on there. Bell Grove Plantation was James Madison's home growing up. And he was the fourth or fifth president. And he grew up there at the Bell Grove Plantation. And the neat thing about it, when I was talking to Michelle, who her and her husband Brett own this house or this inn, and she was telling me about so many different things that go on there. There's a little boy named Jacob. They think he's about 5 or 6, I think. And he loves to, like, when she goes in the morning to make tea, she'll grab a spoon out of a drawer, you know, to stir the tea. And she'll turn around to get the sugar and everything else. And when she comes back, the spoon is gone. And she automatically knows it's Jacob because he likes to take things and put them somewhere else. So she'll tell him, you know, okay, you play with the spoon, bring it back when you're done. And she said, you know, a couple hours later, she'll go back in there and the spoon's laying there on the counter like it never, you know, disappeared. There's some entities outside in the garage. I think she said there's 4 of them that she thinks they used to be soldiers. And she went out one night and left, and, you know, she told them, she usually leaves them in charge of the outside. And she told them, she goes, you know, at least you guys could do is turn the light on for me, you know, when I come home. And she said she went on her way and did whatever she had to do. She came back. It was, you know, getting close to sunset. And she said when she got about 100 feet from the house, the light came on. And she says now whenever she goes out and comes back late at night, that light will come on when she's about 100 feet from the house. I thought that was kind of neat. Then there's also, what is his name? Nathaniel was the first one she met when they first went to look at the house. She'd gone down to the basement and was just taking pictures of, you know, the structure and everything, and said this gentleman, like, apparently was behind her and said something to it, scared the crap out of her. She went on up the stairs and left, you know, went outside. They found out, she found out later that Nathaniel was just trying to say hello. And she said she went back down there and explained to him, hey, you scared me. Please don't do that again. And she says he's been very nice about it lately. So I thought that was, you can make rules for him. You know, don't do this, don't do that. And apparently they will listen. The other thing I thought was neat about Belgrove was they have two ghost cats that run all over. And the neat thing was Michelle then said, you know, and I said, well, do you have cats? And she goes, no, we don't have any animals here. And she had some guests come to her one day and tell her, you know, this is a pretty tabby you've got over here. What's its name? And she says, no, I don't have cats. And they apparently, I think she told me they'd gotten a picture of them up in an upper window of the inn, and you can see both of them sitting there. I don't think I included it in the book, but I thought that was kind of neat, chasing the cats around and there's nobody even there.
I love a ghost animal story. I mean, it also shows that even animals can love where they lived, really, I think, because there are so many of these stories, Susan, over the years, that you can certainly stumble across more, you know, as we were talking about the Cavalier, they've got a ghost and a dog. You've got these pair of cheeky cats just running about and causing havoc everywhere. Would you say that ghost animals in inns seem to be quite common? Because there's a few in the book, and certainly I've heard many a story all over the place of them popping up.
I was going to say, I have several places in here that I've seen the ghost animals. It's, you know, here, let's see, it was Belgrove, Dunlore Inn had some ghost cats, and somewhere else had some ghost cats. I don't remember now, but it was three that I'm pretty sure about. But a lot of them get the same stories in that, you know, they can hear a meow, or, you know, one lady, the Dunlore Inn, she had was taking down drywall, so there was dust all over the floor. And so she saw the dust, so she went downstairs to get a broom to sweep it up. And when she got back, there were these little paw prints going across the sod, I mean, the drywall dust. And I asked her, I said, do you have a cat? And she said, no, we've never had cats. But she said they had about 20 cats that lived there before they bought the location. And they had to go in and, you know, clean all that out, the litter boxes. Some of them had passed already. So I told her, I said, well, maybe they're just still hanging around because they, you know, not ready to leave yet. So, but they get a lot of that with the cats. So I hear more about cats than anything else. You know, different houses I've been to, of course, you know, dogs, cats, you know, other things. Maybe they have a lizard, whatever. But for the most part, yeah, really, ghost lizard. But for the most part, it's cats that I've heard the most about. So.
Yeah, which is quite odd, because I think a lot of people would prescribe any animal to appear in the paranormal. They probably think of a cat more than anything, I think, because of its magical beliefs and the way cats are considered to be a bit more connected with things we can't see, I think.
Yeah, true that. I think, yeah, as we always think, animals can see a whole lot more than we can, so.
Yeah. I mean, was there any place that you discovered on researching this book, Susan, that you thought, I've got to come back here, that you suddenly, you, the first time you'd visited it, you just fell in love, or just thought, how have I never been here before in my life?
Probably two places I can say to answer that question, maybe three, but we'll stick with the one. It was Dunlore Inn in Mineral over here. I found it quite by accident, and I had run out of, like, you know, I told you I had to take five out because they didn't want to be part of it.
Mm.
And so I was looking for some to fill in those spaces. And so I contacted a paranormal friend of mine and that runs a ghost investigation group. And I asked her, I said, do you know of any places in Virginia I could use? She pointed me toward the Dunlore Inn, and she goes, you'll love it there. And I'm like, okay. So I called Sheena, who is one of the owners, and set up an appointment to go over and talk to her. And usually, you know, I go to these places, I stay about a half hour, 45 minutes, you know, just to get pictures and talk to people and see what's happening. I was there for 4.5 hours.
Oh.
And I really was a very interesting place. Sheena is an awesome storyteller, so I enjoyed listening to her as well. But this was a case of this family had bought this particular location back in, I believe it was in the 1915, somewhere in there. And her name was Salina, and her husband George actually built this particular house. And they passed, of course, and Sheena's a little sensitive to that stuff or that particular realm.
Mm-hmm.
And she started, you know, hearing from Celina about different ways to decorate the different rooms. You know, they bought the house and they decided to make it a B&B type of thing. And so Celina was giving Sheena advice on how to decorate the rooms and how to make them look better and all this. And Sheena told me, she goes, I was so thankful for the help, because she says, I am not an interior decorator by any means. And they just went through a lot. Yeah, really. They went through a lot with it, but they have a lot of different entities there. There's one, in fact, I'm looking for his name so you can check him out later. It was a guy, what was happening was there was a painter outside the room, and he was painting the outside of the house, and he heard some whistling inside the house, but he knew there was nobody in there. The doors were locked. Sheena had left. There was nobody in the house. And he heard this whistling come from inside the house, and he's like, what in the world? And then he saw this guy with a white shirt walk down the hallway. And he was still whistling and going on his way. And the guy was like, what in the world? See, nobody was in the house. And so Sheena came back that evening, I guess, and he turned around and asked her about it. And she said, well, that was probably one of the ghosts, you know, trying to just say hello. And I remember putting that in the book somewhere, and I can't find it now. I'm so mad. But that's all he was trying to do, was say hello and let people know that he was there. And I thought that was kind of neat that, you know, they just want you to recognize that they're there. And, you know, that's all I need, you know, say hello and be the end of it. But that was one of the cuter stories. Another cute stories with the little girl. She was there. She was about five, I guess. And they were doing a ghost hunt that night. So Sheena had four adults, and one of the adults had brought her little child with her. And the little girl disappeared for about 20 minutes and apparently went upstairs, just walking around, I guess. She came back down and she had two handfuls of pennies. And nobody could figure out where these pennies came from. And so Sheena asked her, where'd you get the pennies? And she said, upstairs. And she says, we don't have any pennies upstairs. So she went to each member of the group, and, you know, they didn't have any idea what was going on. And so she went back to the little girl, and she goes, well, take me up there. I want to see where you got these pennies. And she goes, okay. And so when you go up the stairs, you know, there's this huge chandelier there. You can't miss it. It's gorgeous. And so they went up, and the little girl pointed up at the top of the chandelier, and she said, the little boy up there gave me the pennies. And she said, what little boy? And she goes, there's a little boy sitting on top of the chandelier. And she said, well, how did he get up there? And she said, he crawled up the wall. And so Sheena told me, she goes, I have no idea where she got those pennies. She goes, but I sure hope he comes back and brings us some more. But yeah, I was, you know, they never did find out where those pennies came from, because she said, I don't have any pennies upstairs. Where'd you get the pennies? So now we have, you know, ghosties hang out, they're handing out coins.
I mean, it seems that Sheena and her husband, they seem very happy to share their business with these residents, because often some people will try and portray having a haunting quite negatively, but they're very positive and very happy that they've got a lot of good ghosts there, they say.
Well, she got several, and then that one I still haven't found his name, and I apologize. He used to he was the one that also, I think he's the one they had found. He sat on the back. There's a back stairwell that the servants used back in the day. And he used to sit back there when he was younger. That's how they would punish him. He'd have to sit on the back stairs. And that's where they found him, on the back stairs. But it was just amazing to me that, you know, these people still keep their personalities, and they're still the same as they were, you know, when they were living. And it's quite a fascinating, you know, if you ever get to visit some of the places that are in this book, I mean, some of them are just so fascinating, because they have, you know, they have either one big entity or they have several little ones. And it's just a fascinating world. It really is.
I mean, yeah, that is the one thing that struck me about this particular collection of establishments, Susan, is that there are a lot of venues that have two, three, even more. And most people seem quite, in the majority, they seem quite pleasant, just sort of haunting around, not bothering anybody too much, just being a little mischievous here and there. And I'm struck because often certain venues or establishments like a hotel or an inn will say they've got one ghost or they know of the haunting, whereas here there are some places that there's more ghosts than guests.
Yeah, some places you know, you can do that. Like I said, some of them have just one ghost, and then some of them have, you know, upwards of 12. So it just depends on, I think, and I've always gone with location. I've never gone with a building because buildings come down, go up, come down, go up. Mm. But I've always gone with what happened here at this location because something told them they got to stay here for some reason, such as go back to Belgrove Plantation. There was he's called a caretaker, and his name was Baldwin Lee, and he lived in a home. It's kind of like catacorner to the house, and he was head of the slave people that were there, and he also was, I think, head of the fields and all that. And he's apparently very mean and very belligerent in life. And Michelle, who was one of the owners, said she would go in his house and just feel just really sick and just really feel bad. And as soon as she walked outside, it would stop. And they found out later some people from some ghost investigations here in the U.S. had come to do a show, and they found out that he may have kept some of the slaves that had passed after him with him in that house. And that's why the feeling was so heavy. And they finally told him, you know, she wound up having to find his grave, which was about 5 miles down the road, and go there and talk to him because it was kind of a neutral spot. And she told him, you know, you've got to let these people go. They don't deserve this. And she was saying that, you know, he would show up in people's pictures as a skeleton, or he would make all kinds of noises and other things to scare people when they got near his house. And so she was telling him, you know, you need to behave, you need to stop acting like this, and you need to let those people go. And when she finished speaking with him, she said, okay, now I'm going back to Belgrove and we can figure this out. And they found out that he was just afraid of being lonely. Mm. And Michelle promised him that, you know, if he would behave and let the other ones go, that she would come and visit with him every day, and he could stay there as long as, you know, he didn't try to scare people or, you know, treat them badly. And she said when she went back to his house again, the feeling was a lot lighter. So don't know what happened to the people that were with him or anything else, but she said it has gotten a lot better since she went to the gravesite and spoke with him about what was going on. So I think you can have any number of entities, but I think you also need to know what their personality was beforehand, because so, and you know what? And throughout all of my travels and such with these two books and other things I've done, I've never really met or seen a mean spirit. I've seen some that are very mischievous. Now, the Baldwin Lee we were just talking about, he may be classified as mean, but I think he had his reasons. But I've never really met a mean spirit. In fact, I've been told by several people, there's a malevolent spirit back there. And it's like, no, I think they're trying to tell you they're here and they just want you to know that they're here. And I hope that, you know, some of them can come to terms with it, because I think a lot of it is people are just scared because, you know, this is happening and I can't explain why it's happening. Mm. And I think, you know, I think some of that leads to that fear. So, and I heard a lot of investigators say the same thing. They're just trying to tell you, hey, I'm here. Yeah. I just want you to acknowledge me. I'm here. So, because I'm not imagining it. If you had died and, you know, you're on the other side and you're just trying to get somebody's attention. I mean, I think a lot of us would go to those links to try to say, hey, I'm still here.
Yes.
You know, that's how I think.
No. Well, I mean, both of your books are a fabulous collection, because often the paranormal light doesn't seem to get shined on places like Virginia very often, Susan. And so these are two fantastic collections for anybody who wants to know a bit more. And like I say, there's a lot of history there. There's a lot of backstories. You've got some fascinating first-hand accounts. Like we say, we've got such a varied collection of ghosts in numerous locations that I think anybody who's interested in the paranormal should get both of your books, because they are excellent collections. And I think when it comes to things like this, I'm a massive fan of places that have these collections, because for me, I think these are modern folklore. Not that I think that these stories aren't real or these experiences aren't real, but I think if it isn't for authors such as yourself, Susan, and others that collect these stories, they'd be lost forever, or we'd only know of two or three of them, or perhaps we'd only know about the Cavalier Hotel rather than numerous other places that you cover in your books.
That is true. That is true. And that's, you know, another reason that to keep that history, like I said, was saying at the beginning, keep that history alive, because if these places get run down and everything else, it get tore down, we don't have any way to look back and say, well, this happened here and, you know, this caused that. So I think keeping them up and running and having people come and visit and, you know, learn that history and see what happened there and, you know, could be fascinating for, you know, a whole new generation. So I think keeping it alive for them is probably the most important thing.
So what's next for you after this? Obviously, the book's gone down very well. I know you were voted third best book of last year in a couple of places. What's your next project? Where are you wanting to investigate and collect your ghost stories from next, perhaps?
Actually, my next one's not actually kind of a ghost thing. It's more of an oddity type thing. I'm doing looking at Richmond and some, you know, some weird stuff that goes on there, is down there, different things. There, you know, for instance, in the city of Richmond, we have a miniature version of the Statue of Liberty. Right. I had no idea. You know, we have one in New York, we have one in France.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's something that I had never seen before, didn't even know it was there. And that got me to thinking, what other kind of stuff, you know, have we got that we never really looked at? And I found, oh my God, the count up to like about 170 things. And I'm going to have to cut that down, of course, because that's not going to fit in the book. But, you know, it was just something weird that hit my mind and I was like, hey, I like that. So that's what I'm working on right now and, totally enjoying that. And then I also have two novels in the works, a paranormal romance and a medical thriller. So they are still ongoing, but I'm starting to get some headway in both of them. So we're good.
Excellent. Well, that's just showing off then, if you've got three projects on the go, Susan, on top of everything else that you've managed to fit into your busy life. So where can everybody get a hold of your books and find your website and keep up to date with what else is going on? But that quirky Richmond project certainly sounds very interesting.
Oh, thank you. You can go to my website. It's www.susanschwartzauthor.com. That's SusanschwartzAuthor. You can go there. I'm on Facebook. I'm on Twitter. I am on Instagram and Snapchat, but I'm not really good at using them yet. So don't expect a whole lot of posts, but those are my main ones you can reach me at. I'm also on Goodreads and Amazon. I have web pages on both of those. So
fabulous. Well, I'll put links to everything in the show notes so people can track down your work and your website and keep up to date with everything. And I just want to say thank you so much for taking the time to take us on a ghostly tour of Virginia and some of your favorite locations and venues that you've visited. So thank you again, Susan, for your time. It's been fabulous speaking with you.
Oh, thank you.